Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Laura.
And I'm Amity. Let's get started. All right, today we're going to finish up Charlotte's Web. We're going to do the last half of it. And I say the last half as if it's just a few chapters. It's 11 chapters, but we're going to whip right through it. So many good things, obviously, as the last part of any book goes. It's the climax. It's the most exciting. It's the most emotional. It's wonderful. And I thought, you know, I don't think that I've ever just taken my time so much with Charlotte's Web before. I was like really emotional at the end of it. It's just, it's really, really good. And I just encourage everybody to, number one, read it, but also just any book. Take your time with it. What was I reading the other day that said something about, like, it's not so important that we read tons of books in our life, but that we take time with the books that we read, because that's how you really get the most out of them and enjoy them and fully experience them.
That's how I feel, like, you know, because we listen to books a lot, right? And a lot of times, if a book is very, very, very interesting, then I totally get everything out of it. But that doesn't happen with every book I listen to. And so the books I actually read, I really read and understand. So yeah, maybe I fly through a lot of books, but a lot of times I'm not taking the time with them. But these have been so rewarding. I was kind of thinking, okay, why are we doing this with like kids' books, right? Like Charlotte's Web. I guess what I'm thinking is I want moms to be inspired to read these books to their kids. And so like listening to us may get you to want to read to them, or you may want to read it to them because you know we're going to do it and then you listen to it. But just kind of adds a layer to the benefits of reading it to your children is, maybe it's the motivation to read it to them. I mean, it's why I'm reading it to Presley.
Yeah. And that's wonderful. And I think, you know, I've said before, I've read hundreds of books to my kids. I don't know that I have slowed down so much to be like, oh my gosh, we need to pull this out and talk about it for a little bit. And so this has really inspired me too, to be like, let's slow down. Let's really enjoy the story. Let's talk about these things, because that's the beauty of it, is it really leads to harder conversations, deeper conversations, and it's those wheels turning. So
yeah. Do you think you see things in this book that you didn't before?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Okay. So chapters 12 through 14, we'll do a little summary of those. So Charlotte, if we recall, we ended the last episode. It was, I think the last chapter was called The Miracle or something. And so Charlotte had done her first grand work of words on her web, and they were some pig, and it drew crowds. It made Zuckerman famous. It made Wilbur famous. And so everybody's feeling pretty good about things. So Charlotte calls a meeting of all the farm animals to get suggestions for a new word to spin into her web. And it's really funny because she does this little roll call and finds everyone is there in the barns, except for Templeton. She admits that what she did seems to be working and she should be able to save Wilbur's life. She's like, yeah, this is going the way I want it to. But she also recognizes that she needs to keep the human sort of guessing and keeping them thinking that Wilbur is this miracle-inducing pig. Together, they come up with a new word, and the word is terrific. She's like, that's a really good word, and I love it. It's really funny because she asks for the spelling, and honestly, I remember as a little kid, terrific is actually kind of a hard word to spell, but it's so funny because like the gander gives his version of the spelling, and it's like T-double-E-double-R-double-I, you know? She's like, what do you think I am? Anyway, so they go through that. And then the old sheep, who up to this point, the sheep had been like super cranky, super unhelpful, but you see sort of everybody transforming as Charlotte takes on this work, and she's so service oriented and others oriented and just loves everybody in the barn. And it sort of changes everybody. And now everyone, it's their concern. So the old sheep pipes up and suggests that Templeton can get words for her from the dump. And then Templeton shows up and they suggest it to him. They're like, you could go get some words for Charlotte. But he's like, not okay with that at all. He's like, what do you think I am? A messenger boy? But I love this too, because the sheep uses logic to convince Templeton that it really is in his best interest to help Charlotte. Wilbur's life, or lack thereof, will determine the course of Templeton's life, or lack thereof. Then there's kind of this point that Wilbur is like, okay, so you're putting terrific in your web, but I'm not terrific. He's like, I'm actually a very average pig. And Charlotte just asserts that he's a terrific friend. And she thinks he's sensational. And that's enough. So Charlotte works really hard on the new word. And she's pays lots of attention to detail, like what kind of her thread she's going to use, which I didn't know spiders could use different kinds of thread, but there it is. She works really hard and gets it done. It has the same, probably a better effect on the humans as her first message did, because it's making them go, okay, well, this wasn't just a one-time thing. It's going to keep happening. This is amazing. And this time Zuckerman actually has the paper called and a reporter comes out and takes pictures. And his own thoughts and his actions have now been completely swayed by this miracle, to the point that he's even like, you know, we shouldn't have the pig sleeping in manure. Let's put in some clean, fresh straw like every day. And then he also,
which he doesn't like as much.
I know. I think that is kind of funny that he's like, you know, this is not as comfortable. Maybe it looks better, but it's not as comfortable. So Zuckerman also has Lurvy build a crate with the words that say Zuckerman's famous pig, because he's determined that in September, he's going to take Wilbur to the county fair. Then it talks a little bit about this dump that they have right there on their farm. And I thought about that and I was like, yeah, at that point, they probably didn't just have trash collectors come and take all their extra stuff to the dump, especially when you're like far out on a farm. And it actually made me think about, this is a little bit random, but my grandparents lived on a ranch in Idaho for several years, and it was like the most magical, glorious place. And I loved it so much. I have like the tenderest, best feelings about that place. But they just had to like burn their trash right in their trash can. Like my grandpa would just go out and burn all their trash because they didn't have a garbage truck come out there. He just put it in a garbage can and burned it like every week. It was interesting. Anyway, so Templeton rummages through the farm dump for Charlotte and he comes back with several that are just like horrible. And she's like, no, we can't do that. But finally he comes back with the word radiant and she's like, yeah, that's perfect. Anyway, it's the end of the first day after she's put the word terrific in her spider web and Wilbur is really tired and he asks Charlotte to tell him some stories. She tells him some kind of random stories about, well, sort of bizarre stories about a couple of her cousins, one of whom like built a spider web over a bit of water, like a creek or something, and caught a fish in it and then like in her web and conquered the fish. So that was crazy. But it's also an amazing story. Another of her cousins who was an aeronaut and a balloonist spider, which is a little bit of foreshadowing. And then she sings him a beautiful lullaby and he goes to sleep. And I'm going to talk about that later. But and then back at the Arable house, Fern is telling her mother all the stories that Charlotte told. Mrs. Arable is now so much more concerned than she already was. She's like, the spider is telling stories? And so she really thinks that Fern is just spending way too much time alone in the barn. And Fern is like, no, I'm not alone. It's a very social place to be. You know, I've got all the animals. So Mrs. Arable pays a visit to Dr. Dorian to get his input and advice. She explains her concerns, but Dr. Dorian just thinks it's quite a lovely thing. And he adds some fresh perspective to it. His thought is that maybe more people would hear animals talk if they actually stopped talking themselves long enough to hear it. And he also like asks other questions about Fern and is like, look, in all other ways, she's healthy and thriving. This is not a bad thing. And she's not going to spend her whole life in Zuckerman's barn. Just like, let her be. This is actually very beautiful and healthy and more people should do it.
So, I love that he's like, she's going to start liking boys and it's going to be okay. Like that's what's going to draw her out of the barn.
I know this part. And like from this point forward, I kept noticing these things like this. And I was like, Fern is 8.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know. I remember watching the cartoon and I was like, oh, they're like Fern has a little crush on Henry Fussy. And then I read this again and I'm like, she's 8. In the little cartoon though, Henry has like a changing voice and Fern is totally not an 8-year-old. So I think they purposely made them both seem quite a bit older than they're supposed to be in the book. So it wasn't like weird, but
that's funny.
She's 8. I'm thinking about my little Audrey who's turning 8 tomorrow. And I'm like, no, boys would not be a concern at all.
Right.
A couple of things that I want to talk about. First of all, I kind of love this. So when Charlotte, you know, presents the idea for the new word to Wilbur, the terrific, Wilbur's like, but I'm not terrific. And Charlotte says, it doesn't matter. People believe anything they see in print. And she's not being snarky or anything about it because, and again, she emphasizes later, she thinks Wilbur is terrific. He's sensational to her. He's a terrific friend. And that is a wonderful thing. But he doesn't have to be like outwardly crazy or terrific to all these people. They're going to believe it because they see it in writing. And I thought that was really interesting and also very telling and true because I think that today, not as many people read, but instead today, it's people believe anything they hear on TikTok.
True.
If it's on TikTok, it must be true, which is like horrifying because anybody and their dog can post on TikTok and it can be like the most inane, stupid things, and people will believe it. I've been just like mind blown by things that like young people will tell me that they're like, oh no, this is true. And I'm like, okay.
You heard about it on TikTok, I know.
Yeah. But yeah, it's like whenever people like it's just human nature. It's like, oh, somebody took the time to write that down or record that. It must be true.
I kind of think about it like the news, right? Like we hear it on the news
100%.
and we just think it's true, right? And
Yeah.
you know, I've noticed that recently with my family and I on our like text thread, my siblings and my parents and stuff. We're talking about Alec Baldwin, who like accidentally shot somebody on set, right?
Oh, that's right.
And a couple of people in my family were like, oh, well, but he's going to be in trouble. I said, he's not getting in trouble. They dropped the charges because what they had originally said when it first happened was the gun that he had, he claims that he didn't pull the trigger. But what the gun that he had, they in the beginning they said it couldn't have gone off if he hadn't pulled the trigger. And then they found out that there it had been modified and it could have gone off. And that's why they dropped the charges, because they don't think that he pulled the trigger. Like it went off.
Interesting.
And what was funny though is like it was in print at one point, so everybody believed it. Just because we hear something, and even in the news when they're like definitive with something like this happened, doesn't mean it happened, because
I
later they
know.
figured out it didn't.
Yeah, and it's like we have to wrap our minds around that and don't take almost anything at face value. Dig a little deeper, do a little more research. It also makes me think, especially with this kind of thing. I was just thinking about resumes actually, and how people will write so many things on resumes. And in where I work, there it's quite transient. And so they're having to like hire people constantly. And so I'll sometimes see a pile of resumes and I'll just sort of glance at the top one or whatever. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that person, why did they even hire me? That person is amazing, you know? And but then I'm like, but resumes are so easy to like trump up and pump up. And you can say you've got all this experience and you worked for like 2 days in that thing. Or, you know, or like it wasn't quite so glamorous as you're saying, or that it seems to be in writing. And so, and I think all the time there, like I was just talking to my kids about this the other day. Don't just automatically assume that you're inferior just because somebody says that they're really good at something. I've had so many experiences where somebody will say like, "Oh yeah, I'm a really good seamstress." And I'm like, or something like that. Like, I don't know, just anything. That one particularly comes to mind because years ago I was helping with sewing costumes for a big community play. And so I went and I was like, "Well, I'll help. Everybody says that they're so experienced and like these great seamstresses, so I'm probably like the low man here, you know, but I love to sew and I've sewed a lot, but like there's no way I'm as good as these people from everything they're saying." And then I went in and I'm hearing what they're all saying and I'm like, "Okay, I guess I'll take the lead." And then I did. And I sewed like almost everything for that show because, and I'm not saying that I was the best ever, but of all those people, I did have the most experience. And so I was just like, just be careful to not take things at face value and to not just assume that you're inferior just because of what people say or write down or whatever. And I have a huge problem with that, is just thinking that there's no way I'm as good as these people. I just believe everything. Anyway.
Yeah, you just think I'm not as good. And like your question, you're insecure about, I mean, that's how I
Totally.
am too. Like I'm
Oh,
just insecure about
100%.
everything. And, you know, there's a couple of things I'm not, but for the most part, most things I'm like, you know, there's a couple of things in your life where you're like, I got this. Like,
Yeah.
I'm
Or
probably the
you just
best one in the
learn,
room.
yeah. Sure. Or you just learn, okay, even if I'm not fully confident, I need to act like I am because I'm in charge of this. And so I'm going to move forward. But
Totally.
yeah.
So one thing I thought of was Charlotte works all night on her web, and they talk about how it's long and boring, and everybody else is sleeping. All the animals are sleeping, and she's up working all night, and she's like doing things in her head to keep herself awake and keep herself going. And I used to think when I was in college, this cracks me up. I cannot wait to be a mom, just be a mom when I can go to bed when I want to go to bed. I can do whatever. There's no deadlines. Yeah. I was such an idiot. I've been thinking about all the times that I stayed up all night finishing Halloween costumes, making Christmas presents, getting up at 3 a.m. to do paper routes so we can support our family. Even now, I spend all day doing things for my family, and then I start my work day after everybody goes to sleep because there was no time during the day to do
Oh,
my
yeah.
work, the work I do for money, right? So
Yeah.
like I'll put Presley to bed, and then at 9:30, I have to drag myself out to the office to work until, 1 o'clock in the morning. And anyways, it just cracked me up. Like all those that everybody in my house is sleeping and the mom is up like slaving. So anyways, what kind of, I wanted to ask you, like, you've told me since we started this podcast about things you stayed up all night doing. So what kinds of stuff have you, besides spinning a web, right? What kind of stuff have you stayed up all night finishing?
For you, the Halloween costume thing, definitely done that. It seems like whenever there's a party, I always go over the top, not Pinterest worthy at all. Like I see these parties on Pinterest, I'm like, holy, what am I even doing here? But I'll stay up all night working on stuff for a kid's party or cleaning, for heaven's sake, because especially like on Saturday nights, because I really like the house to be very clean, everything mopped and just deep cleaned for Sunday. And a lot of times our Saturdays are crazy and everybody can still do their chore and there's still so much to do. And so I'll often stay up all night cleaning. Yeah. Prepping things for school. Yeah. Just everything. I
I
don't know.
know. It just cracks me up that I used to think that being a mom looked easy. Like you go to bed when you go to bed. Yeah, if your kids go to bed first,
Yeah.
and then if you don't have a
And if
deadline
you
in the
don't have
morning.
anything else to do, I know. There was one night a few weeks ago that I stayed up till 1:30 just matching socks.
Yeah, but that was fun. I love matching socks.
Well, and I did put, well, but I was just so exhausted. That was a hard thing. And I did put on a movie, which I never watch movies, so I never have time. So I did put on a movie and I watched a movie while I matched socks. Because we have this sock basket that's always just so full.
Put
And
the
then
kids
God,
on
same
it.
thing, the kids. I know, and we have done that lots of times, but it was just like, okay, this is, everybody's already in bed. It was a Saturday night, and I was like, okay, I'm just gonna do this.
When I years ago I made I'm not the most experienced seamstress either, but like a couple of times I've made Halloween costumes that are pretty impressive. And I'm like, I
Awesome.
cannot, when you're done, you're like, I did have to study the instructions for hours and hours and hours, but I can't believe how this turned out, right?
Cool.
So one year I made Katie a little Red Riding Hood costume. I
Oh, cute.
cannot believe how good that turned out. But I watched Grey's Anatomy all night while I did it.
Oh.
But yeah, you wake up in the morning and the kids are like, "You didn't go to sleep." I'm like, "No, I didn't." So
No. But here's an awesome costume.
yes, but it's amazing. I mean, we had like other kids in the neighborhood borrowing that costume for years because they loved it so much. And I was like, "Look what I did."
That's
I
so
made
cool.
a dinosaur costume for Audrey once that Presley still loves and wears, and
Cool.
then that one. But yes, if I had time, and then I had a lady in the ward ask me if I would sew her grandson a costume. I was like, no.
Much pressure.
No.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't have time to sew my own kids' costumes. So sorry.
But that's awesome, though. It's an amazing compliment to your work.
Yeah. I was
So
like,
that's cool. Man, I had a lot from it this, but I don't want to take up a ton of time. So maybe I'll just like quickly run through some of the things that could be great discussion topics. The first one is, let's see, I wrote down what matters is what the people closest to us think of us, because they're the ones that know us. And this sort of ties back to where Wilbur's like, well, I'm not terrific. Like he's really concerned about this. And Charlotte is like, you are terrific. You're a terrific friend. And I think you're sensational. She's the one that knows him the best. So, like, who cares what other people outside of his circle really think? They don't know him. They may be looking at him and saying, oh, look, it says terrific, but we don't know. We don't really even know what that means. It just says that you're terrific. But she knows that he is. And that is what matters, is what the people closest to us think of us. Also, I loved the little part where Charlotte is working on her web and she's giving herself pep talks all through the night to get through this very difficult labor. And so I just wrote down that positive self-talk helps us to achieve big things. And it really does. It like changes our entire frame of mind. And also just how miracles can change us as we allow them to. Like when we seek for and expect miracles, they happen. And as we allow them to, they can change us, as they totally changed Zuckerman. Like he saw this miracle and it changed how he thought. It changed how he acted. It changed his interactions with people. And I think that's how miracles are in our everyday life. And we all do experience miracles, but we have to be looking for them. I think that a phrase that I love when I think of just our everyday miracles is tender mercies, because I see those as tiny miracles.
That was one of the things I thought about is Dr. Dorian, when he says, first of all, he tells Mrs. Arable not to worry about it, right? Just don't worry about it. Don't be concerned. He's not worried. And it just made, this is really quick, but it just made me remember, like, people were concerned when books started getting published because everybody had their nose in a book. And then their parents were probably concerned when their kids started playing baseball outside too much. And like, now we're concerned about video games. And now we'd be happy if they'd put their nose in a book, right? It just changes. So don't worry, because it'll just change. It'll be something different in a week. But yeah. The second thing is that he points out that the words appearing on the webs are the miracle. They aren't the miracle. The miracle is the web itself.
Yes.
And I was like, how many miracles in our everyday life do we miss? In nature, especially. I mean, like you said, the spider has different threads and different methods of weaving her web, and then she like catches a fly and anesthetizes it. I mean, like, just the spider is a miracle, and like what she does.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. That's something I underlined and put stars by and was going to bring up too, because I love that insight. It's just nobody pointed out that the web itself is a miracle. And I think one of his points in writing is this, is like, there are everyday miracles and we need to stop and appreciate them and notice them and let them change us. And I love the example of the spider web itself. I remember when we first moved to Oregon, I mean, of course I'd seen spider webs before, but they're just not so quick or prevalent in Southern Utah, I think. At least I don't think so. But I remember one day going outside into my front yard in Portland. And during the night, this large spider had spun a web between the bushes and my car. And that's no small distance.
Yeah.
But it was just beautiful. I was like, that is gorgeous and impressive. And overnight, it was just the most beautiful thing I'd seen in a while. And I was like, I can't bear to go anywhere today because I don't want to tear up that spider web because it had somehow attached to my car. Like that was crazy. But yeah, spider webs are really.
And we'll just knock them down.
I know, without a thought. And it's like, no, these things are actually amazing.
All of our daughters are, except Katie, are deathly afraid of spiders. And so we have a lot of like conversations about, you can just step on them. It's not that big of a deal. They can't hurt you. You know what I mean? There are certain sizes of spiders that I won't kill myself. And like, especially if they're up on the ceiling.
Yeah.
But anyways, it's just funny. But then now, from now on, I think I'm going to think about it before I kill a spider and like knock down their web that they've worked so hard on.
I know. Like, I know. Seriously.
Very funny. Okay, so chapters 15 through 17. As the days of summer are winding down and the crickets are, they're singing a morning song, mourning,
yeah.
That the season is ending. And I'm like, I was thinking that's kind of like us, right? Like when the summer starts to end and you're just like, oh, you know, I don't like when summer comes because I realize the kids are going to be home and like, I have to do a lot more dishes and feed a lot more people, but then I get used to it and we enjoy that pace. And then when summer is ending, then it's sad too. So
yeah.
So all the humans and the animals are sad that summer is ending. People are coming to see this special pig. And Wilbur is trying to look good for everybody that comes to see him. He is still afraid that the men are going to kill him to eat. He worries about that at night, but then during the day when his friends are around him and they're pumping him up, then he's feeling good. So I was thinking about that. Like, it's kind of like in the day, everything's fine. And then at night, sometimes you worry. And, you know, when you have people around you that are supportive and helping, that's when you feel good. So he knows he's going to the fair and he thinks if he can make a good impression at the fair, then Mr. Zuckerman will let him live. Wilbur then asks Charlotte if she will go to the fair with him. And she tells him, well, the fair kind of comes at a bad time for me. I don't think I'm going to be able to leave the barn. And she has a lot of work to do. So she says that she needs to make an egg sack and fill it with eggs. And I think she says, I don't know when that's going to happen.
Better to not go anywhere.
Yes. Yeah. And Wilbur suggests, well, you could just lay your eggs at the fair. So she tells Wilbur, I love Charlotte. Don't worry about it. I was thinking, don't worry your pretty little head. I'll figure this out. And Charlotte is concerned because she knows her end is coming. And she's like, what am I going to do when I can't be here to help Wilbur anymore? So the night before the fair, everybody goes to bed early and they're all dreaming about what's going to happen at the fair. Lurvy dreams of playing games and winning prizes. Homer, Mr. Zuckerman, dreams about winning every prize that is there. And then in the morning, everybody's getting ready for the fair. Lurvy puts straw in Wilbur's crate, and Edith, who's Mrs. Zuckerman, gives Wilbur a buttermilk bath. Now, we're reading this, and Presley said to me, how do you think you make buttermilk? She goes, do you just put butter in it? And I was like, well, let's look up a YouTube video and we'll find out how they make buttermilk. I know you can make it by adding lemon juice to milk. Yes. So it's like sour. So I don't know how, we haven't looked it up yet, but do you know how they make buttermilk?
So we used to be part of a farm co-op, which sounds very commercial. It totally wasn't. It was just somebody's personal farm that they didn't have like all the time in the world to take care of. So she was just like, hey, let's do this thing where like anybody who wants to can come. They have to do all the chores on the farm, but then you get to take everything with you. So we would go and milk their two cows and we would feed the chickens and we would take care of all the vegetables in the greenhouse and feed the pigs and the goats and things like that. We would always take like 5 gallons of milk and all the eggs and any produce that was ready. So it was awesome. All that to say, we got to do a lot of things like make our own yogurt and make our own butter. My assumption was that when you make the butter, there's all this leftover stuff. You know, you put the cream in and you churn, or in our case, we would just put it in the Vitamix. But after it's made the butter, there's still all this sort of milk leftover that's not going to go into the butter. We would just strain that off and the kids would drink it. It wasn't sour at that point, but that's what I would call buttermilk. So I'm not sure what makes it sour, if it just sits longer, but yeah.
Interesting.
That's what I would call buttermilk.
I just thought it was cute that Presley was like, buttermilk. How do we make this? So it's the morning of the fair. Charlotte announces she's going. This is exciting. And then, oh my gosh, I just love Templeton. They must want Templeton to go. And he's like, I have no interest in going. And then the old sheep says, the fair is a rat's paradise. I mean, think about it. There is food everywhere. Like, people drop food. There's like leftover dinner, or, you know, and it's like the worst food laying on the ground. Anyways.
Yeah.
So
for food a rat, and junk. It's the best. Yeah.
Yes. And so once he hears that, he's like, okay. So he only does things for himself.
Like, absolutely.
So Charlotte and Templeton, they hide in Wilbur's crate and they warn Wilbur that he needs to resist when they try to load him up, or they're going to think he's, quote, bewitched. And then he gets worried when Mr. Arabelle mentions to Mr. Zuckerman that Wilbur will probably make some good ham and bacon. And oh my gosh, I love this. Wilbur faints, right? I'm like, they have a fainting pig. That is hilarious. Like, don't they have like fainting goats or something? I don't remember.
Anyway. Yeah, there are fainting goats. Yes. Yeah.
But so they have a fainting pig, which is hilarious. And he faints when things happen. Like, I don't know if the humans understand that when they say upsetting things, that's when he faints. So Lurvy goes to get a pail of water and he throws it on Wilbur, and everybody's worried that there's something wrong with him. You know, as soon as they throw the water on, he jumps up And now he's too tired to struggle when they put him in the pen. So, and then as they leave, they go to the fair. The other animals are cheering him on and wishing him good luck. So when they get to the fair, Mr. and Mrs. Arable give the children some money for the day. And I thought it was so funny, all the instructions they gave him, the kids.
I know.
Like 25 things, like pickpockets and don't do this. And make sure if you go on the Ferris wheel, you hold on really tight. And I mean really tight, you know. And then again, Mrs. Arable, she's that parent that's worried. So she's concerned that they won't be all right. And Mr. Arable says, well, they have to grow up sometime. So we got to let them go. So as Wilbur is coming out of the pen, getting unloaded, then all these crowds gather. And Wilbur's pretty happy with where they have him staying. It's grassy and green and he's happy with it. So then Charlotte comes out of the crate. She scurries up onto the roof of a shed, but Templeton decides he's going to stay in the crate until nighttime because daytime really isn't the best time for a rat to be running around at the fair. Charlotte tells Wilbur that she's worried about the pig next to him in the pen next to him because he is so much bigger than Wilbur. And I think Wilbur's funny because he's like this wishy-washy, like, oh, I'm a great pig. Oh my gosh, I'm going to lose. Oh, I'm a great pig. Like, just back and forth and back, just depending on what's going on around him, you know?
Totally.
So Charlotte climbs up there and she drops down right in front of the pig's nose, a snout, which is funny. And Presley was like, there's a picture of that pig in the book. And Presley's like, that's not Wilbur. I'm like, I told her like 7 times, no, it's not Wilbur. And then a few seconds later, I don't think that pig is Wilbur. I'm like, no, it's not Wilbur. It's the one next to him. But you could tell like the drawing in the book, that pig isn't as attractive.
Yeah.
So she got that. They're worried because this pig is so much bigger than him. So Charlotte drops down in front of his snout and the pig tells him that he doesn't have a name, but they can call him Uncle. He does say that he's a spring pig, which means he is the same age as Wilbur.
Yeah.
And so, cause they at first were like, there's no way he could be a spring pig. Okay. So Charlotte comes back to Wilbur and says, I don't really like Uncle, but he's going to be hard to beat. Because he's so big. And then she says she has a plan to help him anyway, help Wilbur win anyways. So he asks her when she's going to start spinning a web. And she says, I'll do it later. And she also tells him that she's been tired a lot lately. So as people are coming to see them, Wilbur hears them talking about how big Uncle is. So again, here we go. He's feeling insecure because they're talking about this other pig. So at lunchtime, all the humans come back and sit down for a picnic. And then Wilbur overhears Mr. Zuckerman saying that the judges are going to decide who the winning pig is tomorrow. So that is it. And I already said the thing I had pulled out of there was that he goes back and forth between feeling good and feeling bad, depending on who's he's hearing at the time.
Who is he hearing? Yeah. Which I think is an important lesson, isn't it?
How many times you go into a situation feeling secure, confident, and then you hear something or you see something, or like maybe you're going to a competition and you see somebody else, like another team, walk in and you watch them warm up and you're like, oh, I thought I had this. I don't know.
Seriously. And I think that's probably where that positive self-talk comes in, and just like having this confidence that doesn't mean that you're egotistical, but just confidence that you're enough just the way that you are in that situation. It doesn't mean that you don't think there's ever room for improvement, but just it's going to be okay. Keep giving yourself that positive self-talk to be like, no, I'm fine and I'm going to do my best and be my best and let the chips fall where they may. Yeah, because you can't be somebody that's reliant on everybody else for how you feel about yourself. That's not a good place to be.
I heard a talk this week that was like, don't ever compare yourself to other people because that puts you either below or above them.
That's, yeah, absolutely. 100%. And I think a lot of times when we say, oh, don't compare yourself, we think, oh, you know, so you don't feel worse than people. But that really is true because we often will also be like, oh, look, I'm so much better than them. We totally do. And it actually makes me think about whenever something bad happens to a child, the first thing people do is attack the parent. Like if a child is left in a hot car and they die because like the schedule was off that day or something, the parent just like completely forgot about it. Or maybe they're hit by a car because they were like, they backed out and didn't know the child was there. Or, you know, things like that that are like awful, like worst nightmare level. And immediately everybody's like, I would never do that. that would never happen to me. You guys are horrible. Like, what kind of a parent are you? You know, you don't deserve to be a parent. And it's like, okay, so you're saying that because you're hoping it would never happen to you. And you're wanting to make yourself feel better and to put yourself above them, when really it could happen to anybody. Like, don't speak too quickly, because these are horrible accidents. And we want to say that we're better and it would never happen to us, but it totally could.
I don't know if you've driven a new car lately, but since I got my car accident, I drove several. Because we had to rent and stuff. Anyways, they all now, when you turn off your car, it beeps and it says, check your back seats.
Oh, that's like, really nice.
Across the...
That's cool.
Yeah. It's anyways, but that's because it can happen to anyone.
Because it can happen to anybody.
Yeah.
There were a couple of things. One of them that, you know, when you talked about how Charlotte was like not sure if she could go to the fairgrounds because... In fact, she wasn't planning on it because she knew that she would be laying all of her eggs and creating this egg sack, which would be just a huge undertaking. And she understood it. Wilbur did not. He was like, no, come on. It'll be so much fun. And she's like, you don't know the first thing about egg laying, Wilbur. And I just thought, how many times does that happen? When either we make assumptions about things that we really don't know about, we think we do, but we don't, or people make assumptions about us or things that we do that they think they know about. And we're like, no, you don't know. This is kind of a stupid example, but I remember years ago, I've been a runner for like ever, for like 18 years. Somebody in our family was like, you know, I think I was talking about running a 5K, and she was like, yeah, I just don't think running a 5K would even be a challenge at this point. So I think I would go for more like a half marathon or something. She was not a runner. She had done a couple of 5Ks. She could cover the distance, but that's not racing a 5K.
Yeah.
A 5K is like really, really difficult if you're racing it, because you're like pushing your guts out for 3 miles and you're always trying to get faster. If you're it. Sure, if you're just wanting to cover the distance, it's not difficult, but if you're racing it, it's really difficult. And so it just made me laugh. Like, okay.
Well, it's like, what's your goal? Is your goal to finish it or to win? I mean,
yeah,
me
or to like, or even if it's not to win it, to like best your last time. Like, there's a lot of different levels of running a 5K, you know, or 10K or a half marathon. You don't even necessarily have to have the goal to. But that's my point. There's like so many different aspects of it. So to just say, oh, it's not challenging.
You'd be like, okay. Yeah, finishing it isn't challenging because I can walk it.
You can walk it. You can like crawl a 5K.
Yes. That's a funny.
Anyway, but there's just lots of things in life that people like will make assumptions about, or we make assumptions about. And then we learn later, I'm an idiot because I just didn't even know. And then just the last thing I just wrote down, we live up to expectations, because it says when Charlotte's web said some pig, Wilbur had tried hard to look like some pig. When Charlotte's web said terrific, Wilbur had tried to look terrific. And now that the web said radiant, he did everything possible to make himself glow. And I kind of love that. And I think that it's really important for us to ignore negative things, because a lot of times, you know, or to be careful with our children, because they will live up to negative expectations. We have positive expectations, they will live up to positive expectations, and for ourselves as well. So chapters 18 through 20, there's a lot in this last half of the book. So this one may be a little bit of a longer episode. It's fine. Evening comes to the fairgrounds, and Templeton has decided to venture out. Charlotte sends him to find one last word, and she keeps saying, this is the last one I'm ever going to write. So he finds the word humble, which is perfect. And she spins it into her web before the fair closes for the night. And it's also important to note that like the family, the Zuckermans, the Arables, they had like napped for a while. And then in the evening, it was so much cooler. It had been super hot during the day. So they went out and did all the rides and everything. And then they left when it was super dark. You know, they said goodbye to Wilbur and stuff, but they did not notice Charlotte's web. Yeah. Also, I just wrote down Fern goes on the Ferris wheel with Henry Fussy, and she loves it. And it just like goes into that. And I'm like, again, she's eight.
Apparently E.B. White is out of touch with 8-year-olds and didn't have a lot of experience with where they're at.
That's kind of what I'm wondering. Or maybe, you know, maybe at that time, 8-year-olds were just a lot more mature. I don't know. But I'd be like, no, stay away from the boys. Anyway, that night, though, Wilbur does notice that Charlotte is not in her web. And she's in this dark upper corner. He's just like, what are you doing? And she says, I'm creating something as usual. And she says that it is her masterpiece and she'll show him in the morning. Back at the Arable home, Fern says that the day at the fair was the best day of her life. So the next morning at the fair, Charlotte presents her magnum opus, her egg sack, to Wilbur. It has 514 eggs in it, and it has completely drained her of life. She just says, like, this is the best thing that I've ever done, and I'm just really sad because I'm not going to be able to see my children. And she's like, yeah, I am languishing. Basically, she's fading away. Her life is coming to an end. And Wilbur just doesn't get it. He just doesn't get it. He just doesn't understand. Templeton, at that point, he returns after a night on the fair, just a night of absolute gluttony. He's a pretty great character and a horrible character at the same time. It's kind of great to have him in there because there's just this amazing contrast that you can see between him and Charlotte. He's like, oh, by the way, the pig next door already won first prize. So Wilbur, you're done for. You're going to be ham and bacon and everything. And like you said before, like Wilbur's like, no, and, you know, rides that wave.
Does that remind you of kids? Like, I feel like because we have one little child now. Yeah. And I'm much more observant. I don't know. I was observant probably when that we had the other kids too, but like kids are hilarious. Like yesterday I took Presley and a little friend to the park, and there's a blue swing that everybody wants to swing on. And then there's all these black swings that nobody wants to swing on. And the child would get off the swing and say, Presley, you want the blue swing? And then she'd be like, yeah. And she'd start going to it and they'd run to it. Like this just reminded me of Templeton. Like, well, the pig next to you, he already got first prize. So I don't know. It just reminded me of kids.
Totally.
Or like, it's you want my toy? No, I'm keeping it forever. Like they were arguing yesterday over a stick that somebody had found. And I kept saying to him, this is a stick, you guys. Come on. They're like, I'm going to take it home and hide it from you. And I'm like, it's a stick.
But also everything is like a competition.
Yes.
They're sort of trying to establish dominance, even if it's just, I get the stick or I get the swing. So the Arables and the Zuckermans return to the fair and they finally see Charlotte's web. And they also, and of course, they're like really excited about that. But they also see that the pig next door has won first prize. So they're all just like in total despair. They're a lot like Wilbur that way. They're like, oh no, everything's over. But just at that moment, they hear a voice over the loudspeaker. And it says, basically, well, Mr. Zuckerman, we need you to crate up your pig and bring him to the grandstand because we have a special award that we're going to present. Everyone is very delighted. I wanted to see exactly what it said about Charlotte. Up overhead in the shadows of the ceiling, Charlotte crouched unseen, her front legs encircling her egg sac. Her heart was not beating as strongly as usual, and she felt weary and old. But she was sure at last that she had saved Wilbur's life. And she felt peaceful and contented. So at that moment, when they called him to the stand and said, we have a special prize, she was like, we did it. And I love that it brought her peace. Okay. So they go up to the grandstand, pushing their way through all these people. And everybody's kind of fidgety. Oh, does my hair look fine? Tuck in your shirt. But it's kind of funny because the whole time Fern is like not wanting to be there. She wants to go back to the Ferris wheel. She's like, can I have some money? I want to go back to the Ferris wheel. And so I think it really is like, look, Fern is growing up. She's moving past these things. And I did want to add that Templeton went along with them too. And this was very fortuitous. And we'll see why in just a little bit. Now, Charlotte, of course, is back in the barn, totally just extremely exhausted. She is dying. But as she hears everything being said over the loudspeaker, she's like, this is her hour of triumph. You know, it all came through to fruition. And so it all worked. So up at the grandstand, the loudspeaker guy, he's like, you know, all this stuff happened. Look over the summer. If you recall, you know, it became very evident that this was no ordinary pig. He says, we are dealing with supernatural forces here and we should all feel proud and grateful. And I had to kind of laugh at that a little bit because it was like, it is miraculous, but they don't understand it. So they just say, oh, it's supernatural. And so he's like, yeah, it's just some pig. But, you know, so he like really praises Wilbur for a while. And then he says, whence came this mysterious writing? Not from the spider. Spiders are very clever at weaving their webs. But needless to say, spiders cannot write. It's like we can't explain it. So we're going to fall back on what we think we know and just say, well, this can possibly really happen. And it just made me think about miracles in general. We can't explain them. So we still try to explain it in a way that doesn't actually make sense. But they give Mr. Zuckerman $25 and a very nice bronze medal to hang around Wilbur's neck. And in that moment, as they're like praising him and all this stuff is going on, Wilbur faints again. He faints again in front of all these people. And I could just imagine Mr. Zuckerman just being completely horrified. And he's like, Lurvy, go get water again. Like, it's totally a repeat of what happened. He tried to say, oh, he's just modest. He can't send all the attention. Templeton, like I said, he's there and he's like, I'll take care of this. So he goes and he bites Wilbur's tail and Wilbur jumps right up because of the pain. And everybody's like, oh, yay, he's up, he's up. And just in that moment, well, it was like a couple minutes later, Lurvy comes back with his bucket of water and he's just like, he's so focused and so intent and he just like throws his bucket of water. And so it gets all over Mr. Zuckerman and Avery and they're just completely soaked. He's like, you told me to get water. And Mr. Zuckerman's like, I didn't ask for a shower bath. But what I kind of love is that Avery uses this opportunity to totally show off to the crowd. I'm like, yeah, what a ham. And it's totally just not all young boys, but a lot would definitely use that opportunity in the best, most advantageous way possible. So that's what he did.
The only thing I have for this is like, as I was reading this, I just kept thinking about how Charlotte, now you could be, I don't know, this could be obvious to everybody else, right? But how Charlotte is like a god or a Christ figure.
Absolutely.
Wilbur's totally just an ordinary pig. Like, he's just a pig. Like, there's nothing special about him. But Charlotte believes in him and like builds him up. And like with her, he can do all these things. Anyways, I just kept thinking about that, just how Charlotte is just like God is to us.
100%. And that's what I kept thinking the whole time is that this story is a wonderful metaphor for Christ. And I feel like, isn't that interesting that a lot of the classics we've read, they totally point that way in my mind. And it is beautiful. And it's a wonderful way to explain it to children and how she doesn't want all the praise. And I think later on, she literally says like, it is enough, you know, and also that, well, we'll get into it later when you talk about it.
And then like, as she's getting sicker and sicker, you know, okay. And I'll talk about this later when I talk about the book that I'm reading right now, but like sometimes she's right there and like, he can see her.
Yeah.
And sometimes she's hidden and he can just hear her voice, but yet she's still supporting him and like giving him what he needs to do. Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just, as she was getting sicker and he was like, where are you? And she's like, he's like, I can hear you. You know, I don't know. It just reminded me of somehow how we feel about God.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. He's always there, always present, always supporting us. And I've thought about that too when we talked in the other episode about how like she always tells the truth, but never drags him down. It's like, yeah, it's a possibility that you could die. Also, I'm going to save your life, you know? And so it's like, yeah, it's a possibility that you're going to like royally screw up and you're going to make lots of mistakes and you're going to sin. Also, I'm going to save you.
I was thinking about like Jesus in the garden, right? Just like how basically she's giving her life.
And
And she gave all of her energy to him, like really to her eggs, but also to him. And that's how like Christ is to us. He gave it all in the end for us so that we could live.
Absolutely. And along those same lines, like something that I wrote down from this section was just, she kept talking about how her egg sac is her magnum opus. Like she'd done these wonderful things to save Wilbur's life, but the magnum opus was creation, being able to create new life. And it made me think, well, first of all, that is like tying directly back to God, of course, who is the creator, and man is his ultimate creation. He created all life on earth, but also that partnership that we have with God in being able to create life ourselves. And that is our magnum opus. I remember listening to Jordan Peterson and him talking about how like he's worked with so many high powered individuals who just like are high achieving, highly successful, just amazing in their careers. Well, he specifically says women, and this can be controversial, and that's fine. But he's worked with hundreds and thousands and whatever. But he's like, they get to a certain point where that is not enough. They need some meaning in their life. They need to truly create. And of course, they're creating with all these successful careers and stuff. But they need the creation that comes from creating a new life and raising that life and loving that child and helping that child become the best human it can be. And that's what truly brings meaning and purpose. So that was really interesting.
I love it. Okay. Did you have anything else before we go on to 21?
I don't think, well, I guess I actually did write down toxic friends as opposed to uplifting friends because like,
Templeton.
Yeah. Templeton. It's like, there are a lot of good things that he does. In fact, he'll, in the chapter you're going to do, he goes through and he lists all these good things he does. And it's like, again, like don't believe things at face value, because if you just took the list of things that he did, it'd be like, oh, he's amazing. No, he's horrible. He's such a toxic person and not person, rat character, because his intent and the heart behind it is so wrong. All for him. Yeah.
Yeah. And he doesn't do anything. He's like a child. That's what I just
think.
It's like, they don't do anything unless it takes maturity to do things for other people that won't benefit you, you know? And maybe rats don't ever mature. I don't know.
At least this one doesn't.
The last two chapters of the book, 21 and 22. So after Wilbur wins, Charlotte gets very quiet. And she says she's tired. And this just reminded me of like the Savior. Like she's peaceful and grateful that he's won, but she's tired and quiet. And she's grateful that she has saved Wilbur.
Yeah.
Wilbur wonders what he ever did to deserve her. And he feels like he hasn't done enough for her. That's like us.
There he is. Yeah.
So Charlotte says to him, just being my friend, that was enough. And in helping Wilbur, it has lifted her life a trifle. That's how I feel about like when we help other people, like that's the key to getting out of our own sorrows and problems, right? Is when you can focus on other people and helping them, it will lift us up and make us feel better. Okay. So Wilbur's talking about how wonderful it's going to be when they all get back to the barn. And Charlotte breaks the news that she's not coming with them. She tells him she's going to die. And she doesn't even think she has the strength to get back into the crate. So Wilbur goes into his dramatics again, throwing himself on the ground. At least he's not fainting, I guess. But so he either faints or he throws fits. He's like laying on the ground in his pain and sorrow. And, you know, he goes into like, I'm losing my only true friend. This is just the worst thing ever. And Charlotte tells Wilbur to stop making a scene. Can you imagine a pig that's just like
so dramatic?
It's just funny. It's funny to give animals like human-like traits, right?
Yeah, totally.
Anyways, so Wilbur decides that if Charlotte can't bring the egg sack back with her, then he's going to take care of it. Now, another interesting thing about all these animals and how they interact with each other is that they can't do certain things. So like Wilbur needs help getting the egg sack, but he can't get it himself. And so he relies on Templeton to do that part for him. He can't spin a web. And so he relies on Charlotte to spin the web. They kind of, the animals help each other with skills and things that each of them don't have. It's like people, right? Like,
yeah, totally.
I can do this. You can do that. We'll help each other. So he wants to bring the egg sack back with him. And so he tells Templeton his plan. And he tells him that Charlotte is sick and needs Templeton to go up into the shed and get the egg sack. And of course, Templeton does not want to do it, but just because, not because it's going to hurt him or anything, just because it's work. And he's like,
just because it's work.
And he's like, I'm tired of doing stuff for you guys. Yeah. Every time he does something, it's because it's going to benefit him. But Wilbur decides to make him a deal. And he says, if you will do this, then every meal I get, you'll get first dibs at it. You'll get to eat as much as you want. I won't even touch it until you get to eat it. So he's like, of course. Yep, I'm in. So he agrees to bring the egg sack down. And so he goes up into the rafters and he carries it down in his teeth. And then he complains about how it was gooey and yucky in his mouth. So Templeton lays the egg sack in front of Wilbur and Wilbur puts it in his mouth and holds it on the top of his tongue. And then he winks at Charlotte and she waves one of her legs at him. And then he gets in the crate with the egg sac in his mouth. And Charlotte dies peacefully the next day. This has just reminded me of like somebody that like has cancer or is just like kind of slowly fading, you know, and I don't know. It's just so sad. And this reminded me of Christ. Mm-hmm. Nobody's with her and nobody knows what she's done, like that she has done this miraculous thing at the fair. And anyways, yeah, like this whole last few chapters was just like blaring to me, like, that's what, I don't know if that's what he was doing, but it seemed
from so many of the different phrases and things, like the fact that he bothered to write in there, did it say exactly like no one was with her? No one was with her when she died. Isn't that like pretty close to the exact same phrase when it described, you know, Jesus suffering in the Garden of Gethsemane and no one was with him? Because yeah, he was alone. He was suffering in absolute silence. So I just don't feel like that is a coincidence.
Yeah.
That's how he phrased it.
So when Wilbur gets home, he puts the egg sack in a safe place and Mr. Zuckerman hangs Wilbur's medal over his pig pen on a nail. And then Wilbur just keeps getting bigger and bigger and he's not worried about getting turned into ham and bacon anymore. Fern starts spending less and less time with him, more and more time with Henry Fussy, which that name, just Henry Fussy, that just cracks so me up. It is such a name. And Templeton just continues to eat Wilbur's food, which is funny because Wilbur is probably nothing to Wilbur, right? Like it's probably the smallest amount. And I just love it. So, and then I like that the sheep chastises him for being greedy. And he's like, I don't care. He's like, eating is more important than living a long time. And like, I kept thinking, how many of us have that philosophy in life? Like eating is just better.
Whether
than
we verbalize it or not, our actions would suggest that's our belief. Yeah,
exactly. Wilbur just keeps guarding the egg sack as if they were his own children. He keeps looking at Charlotte's web that she left the last time. And then eventually it goes away. And so the egg sack eventually, what did you say? 514 spiders were in that. Yeah. I wonder how many of those survived, but that is quite the legacy. They all emerge from the sack and he introduces himself to them. Three of her daughters become his friends. Oh, I love this too. That afternoon when he wakes up, he hears somebody say salutations. So it's like, back to
there,
which is funny because she's not even around. Okay, so there's three spiders, her daughters, Joy, Irania, and Nellie. He tells them about their mother and what a great friend she was to him. And he says, I'm going to be your friends forever and ever. And he's alive through several generations of these spiders. It never is replaced. Like Charlotte is never replaced in his heart. Though he loves her descendants, none of them ever quite take her place in his heart. That is the end. I mean, and that's just funny how we, you know, we do have children and we like kind of pass on our legacy so that when we go, there's still something. So, you know what I mean? There's still part of us here.
Yeah, it's really true. Did you talk about how almost all the spiders flew away?
Well, no, I didn't say that specifically, but there was 514 and they wave at him.
Yeah.
And like leave, right?
They hung out for a little while until they grew to be the size of BBs. And then just one day they all like sprouted these strands, webbing. They're like, see ya. He's like, don't go. He really didn't want them to go. And they said, well, we're aeronauts, kind of like Charlotte's cousin was. And they flew away and he's like, where are you going? And they said, wherever the wind takes us, you know? And so it was just those three that stayed there. Because they were not flyers. They were stayers. They wanted to stay right there. And like you said, just over the generations, many more were born, many more flew away, but there were always some that stayed in the barn. Excellent, excellent book. And like I said, I hope it's just inspiring to read, especially with your children, and have great discussions.
When I was thinking about books like this, I was like, we kind of already went over most of them because they're like books about animals that talk. I did think of, I don't know. Can you think of any books that were written in a barn?
So I don't know if we really talked. Well, we have, but I think all of the Little House books would be really wonderful because Laura Ingalls Wilder, really does take time to appreciate nature and its miracles. And So I think that that's a really good one. Good series that kind of ties together with Charlotte's Web.
Similar to The Wind in the Willows, right? Because we got animals that are
talking animals.
Yes, because you've got the little girl Fern in here. So mm-hmm. I like that idea of Little House on the Prairie or yeah, Little yeah. House in the Big Woods, or all of those books would be great.
Yeah, the entire series, because all of them, you really just get this great appreciation for nature and all that has to offer and all of its magic and beauty. I guess if you wanted a better perspective on rats, you could read Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. But
oh, The Mouse and the Motorcycle, or I don't know.
True. Yeah,
just think, or like true. The Borrowers comes to mind.
Mm.
Yeah, there's lots of children's books that could go along with it. But yeah, I didn't do my homework this time. So actually, after this episode, we're going to take the month of June off. And then we will be back in July with The Island of the Blue Dolphins by Scott O'Dell. We're excited about that one. That should be fun.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book and kind of unique.
And then after that one, so we'll probably do we'll have to see when we get into it, two or three episodes of that one. And then we're going to jump in with Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. Woo-hoo. And we're going to have a special guest with us for that book. So we have a mutual friend that loves Jane Austen. So she'll be fun to listen to.
Yes, I agree.
So what I'm reading has something to do with kind of what we were just talking about. It's called Divine Quietness by Emily Robeson Adams. It's about this lady who had an experience where God went silent and she like couldn't get any revelation. She couldn't get like, she didn't feel him in her life. It's like how she dealt with it. And it's been really interesting. And that's what I was thinking about with like Charlotte, like disappearing. Like, and what I'm really liking about it is she realizes it wasn't God that went quiet. It was her, like he's always there. And she, it was the reason he went quiet is she was basically like demanding things from him and like saying, I need this answer. I need this answer. And how often do we think God needs to act in a certain way? Or if we do these certain things, he will do this. And how we need to just kind of back off and say, wait a second, how many people in your life will do exactly what you're expecting them to do all the time? And yeah, God's just the same as everybody else. And so she was just kind of like, yeah, it's really good. Anyways, I just think it's a lot to think about. Like, why does he go quiet? Is it something I'm doing? It's not, maybe not something I'm doing wrong, but am I contributing to it? He didn't disappear. He just went quiet. It was very good.
That sounds really wonderful. Cool. Okay. I'm going to try to get my hands on that one.
Yeah, I heard about it on a podcast and I was like, oh, that sounds really interesting. And I've really enjoyed listening to it, or I'm actually reading it, but it's very deep though, you know, I mean, deep, but not like you could go in and study it deeply, but also you can get out of it what she's trying to say.
That's cool. Well, I feel like that's a sign of a very well-written book.
Yeah. And she's a lawyer. So she's well-written. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's well-written. So
that's great.
What are you reading?
Okay, by very stark contrast and with some trepidation, I will share the one that I just listed. I had seen it recommended like everywhere and I'm like, why? And it's supposed to be like a top 100 bestseller. Let me just lead off by saying I do not recommend. If anyone does listen to it or read it, please don't judge. It's called The Perfect Marriage by Geneva Rose. It was horrible. It's supposed to be like a sort of a psychological thriller, like keeps you guessing to the end. First of all, it didn't really, like pretty soon in, I kind of figured it out, but it was one of those I'm like, well, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. So I guess I'll listen to the whole thing. It went, and it also wasn't that like terribly long. Overall, I think that it was pretty well written and everything. There is so much language in it, so much language. And I was like, what is wrong with this author? Like, nobody really talks like that. Why are they writing it like people talk like that? I just don't, like, I don't think people do. But anyway, it's basically the story about this very high profile defense attorney who finds out, like, she gets a call one day that her husband is put in prison or put in jail, has been arrested on charges of murder. And he has apparently murdered the woman he was having an affair with, and she had no idea he was having an affair. But she's like, well, I'm the best defense attorney that he has, and all the evidence is stacked against him. Like, it looks pretty bad, but so she's like, well, I'm going to defend him.
Wow.
Anyway, so all this stuff goes down, and it's pretty wild.
Did he kill him?
So many times throughout the book, says the fact is he did not kill her. He didn't, but who did? You find out at the very, very
oh,
end.
I bet it was his wife.
Totally was. See? You didn't even need to read the book. That's the thing. I was like, why is this like recommended everywhere?
Yeah. How would she like defend him with the knowing that he'd done it? I read a book once where the murderer got himself on the jury for a trial against,
what?
Like, so they were charging somebody else for the murder. The
Oh,
actual murderer was on the jury.
On the jury. Oh, that's kind of an interesting story plot.
Yeah, it was. I think it was called like the 13th juror or something like that.
Okay.
Anyways, I'll have to look that up, but
yeah,
that's funny. But like, how do you defend your husband when you were the one that committed the murder? I don't know. That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, she had like worked with another person and just had all these things perfectly in place. And yeah, it was kind of unbelievable. And again, like the writing, I'm like, you take out all the cuss words and you just cut this book in half. It was like, I don't know.
I know. I'm like, I'm really free with that kind of stuff, like with language, but there's a point where it's like too much.
Yeah. And that's where this one was because, yeah, like, okay, every once in a while when there's a word dropped, it's like, okay, just like move on. But this, yeah, it was over the top. So I would just say, I'm sorry, everybody, don't read it. It was bad. Yeah. I'm not a better person for having read it. I need to like, yeah, do a serious detox. I guess I was like, so I had just finished that book, The House with No Windows. And it was very, very good, very informational, very like, you're feel this need for justice and almost a sense of rage for the women of Afghanistan who just have no justice. It's so unfair. And it's like, okay, so much more needs to happen over there. I don't know what we can actually do, but it was very drawn out. Like, I felt like it just kept going and going. So that kind of like tired out my brain. And I was like, hey, I just need something easy. I'd seen this recommended everywhere. And that's what I went with. And it was a very poor decision. So we're so happy you joined us for this episode. We are taking a short break. And then we hope you will join us on July 7th as we discuss The Island of the Blue Dolphins by Scott Odell, chapters 1 through 15. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you in July.